thanks. So my fortune cookie yesterday said that if you don't have any, you can't have success without critics. So I hope that there are some critics in the audience here. So basically, the gist of my talk today
as a result or a precondition.
The problem is I couldn't remember the exact phrasing. A lot of the talks that we've seen so far in the tutorial have dealt largely with tree-level amplitudes or with quantities that can be constructed purely from tree-level data. For example, by using the generalized unitarity method that David Kossauer talked about. However, a lot of people aren't really going to, I'm going to say more about this later, but a lot of people aren't really going to believe that any of this is really exciting until you actually see some magic wand that can do something dramatic to results for amplitudes that you get after integrating them. If you've ever had experience with this, you know that they can be quite beastly and complicated objects. So you're not going to take any of us seriously here until we can, you know, show you what we're good for. So that's basically the sort of meta outline of my talk. So let me start by just saying a couple of words. Maybe this is no longer necessary. But why n equals 4? Of course, the first reason that we're interested in n equals 4 is that it's there, and we can solve it. So let's do so. One of the great things, Nima emphasized this in one of his talks, one about the great things about n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory is that we're not reliant on funding for massive experiments. You know, if there's any question we want to know the answer to, in principle, you just have a couple of starving grad students go calculate for 5 years, and then you have your answer. So all of the data is there, in principle. It's just a matter of trying to figure out how to extract it and do something useful to it. I also say, I can say, it's a cousin.
Well, there's the same problem with experimentalists, right? Starving graduate students don't always get the right answer.
Okay. Well, yeah, indeed. Now, one of the important points is if someone came to you tomorrow and said, hey, I've invented this great four-dimensional interacting quantum field theory, a non-trivial quantum field theory in four dimensions, and look, it's totally solvable. You know, if it were just some random Lagrangian that someone had made up that had absolutely nothing to do with anything, you might not really care. But n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory has the pleasant feature that it's not just some random Lagrangian, it's a close cousin, or in this audience, I should be more careful and say a distant estranged cousin, but a cousin nonetheless of QCD, which is, of course, extremely important to the real world. So we're interested in n equals 4 also because it's a close cousin of QCD. Of course, we all know that its raison d'etre is to provide a non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity. But for this purpose of for the purpose of this audience, I'll leave that aside.
One question. So when you say we can solve it, you mean?
I'm gonna go into great detail about that point.
Well, in particular. What about all non-perturbative information?
I'm gonna go into that point. Yeah. Well, did that no? Come on, speed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, but you're the one. You're the pioneer, right? You paved the way beyond the planar limit. So.
Yeah, but no, I'm not.
No, I'm going to speak much more forcefully than you would feel comfortable talking about your own work. So, of course we're going to solve it. Okay. It's a cousin of QCD. And finally, I think the most important point is that what we're really interested in are the methods. Because if you want to develop new calculational methods or new mathematical insights, you want to do it in a sandbox that's as clean as possible, right? So that you can understand the structure, you can really see what's going on, and once you really understand what's going on, then you can look at other cases and see to what extent your methods may be applicable or what modifications might have to be made. I mean, the primary example of this is BCFW, which of course we now understand very well how to apply to all kinds of amplitudes at tree level, whether you've got adjoint particles or fundamentals, whether you've got massive particles or massless. But clearly it's the case that it's in the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory that BCFW takes its simplest form, and it's necessary to have a clean sandbox for you to learn about and develop new methods, which you can then hope to apply more generally. Okay, so that's the why. Now the question is, what do we want? And the short answer is everything. So correlation functions. Okay, when you talk about solving a conformal field theory, you can ask for all correlation functions. Since this is a gauge theory, you can ask for Wilson loops. You can say, I want a mechanism for determining the answer for any Wilson loop. These are sort of, they contain, morally speaking, equivalent information, but packaged in completely different ways. And of course, you could say scattering amplitudes. Okay. Now, generally, in a conformal field theory like N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, you're not allowed to say the word scattering amplitude. And normally, you have to mumble something that, oh, you know, be quiet and go home, you know. But one of the remarkable things about N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory is that we now know that scattering amplitudes are, in fact, identically equal to certain Wilson loops and also to certain correlation functions. So this has been called triality by Emery Sokachev. Triality, yeah. So it's all good. Okay, so how far can we go? It's often said, well, let me give you some examples. And the biggest success, I think, in the larger community in which we work is that two-point correlation functions are now solved, completely solved in the planar limit. By two-point correlation functions, of course, I essentially mean anomalous dimensions. So thanks to the work of dozens of people over several years, there now exists machinery in the form of sets of algebraic equations which, if you're sufficiently clever, you can use in principle to solve for the anomalous dimension of arbitrary operators for arbitrary values of the coupling constant. So this is the main triumph of the integrability community. Work has just recently started gearing up on a more serious level to attack higher point correlation functions. Of course, we anticipate that they're more complicated because they have actual space-time dependent. Well, three-point functions don't have non-trivial space-time dependence. So, four-point functions do. But I guess once you know three-point, you've got everything. So, work is gearing up to begin the problem of attacking three-point correlation functions. And I think it's fair to say that people within the community believe that this is a solvable problem in the sense that there will be some machinery that will let you calculate arbitrary three-point functions. And hence, you can imagine bootstrapping to arbitrary correlation functions. Now, so for many years, it's been said that, of course, you need to qualify the word integrable by saying in the planar limit, right? Because, you know, when you start talking about non-planar corrections, then by ADS-CFT, you're talking about gravitational processes such as black hole formation and black hole evaporation. And those things can't possibly be integrable, can they? And my reply to that is that it all depends on what your definition of integrable is. So people within a certain small subset of the community have a really, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on the microphone, but a really anal definition of the word integrable, that it means some very precise notion in a two-dimensional, like a spin chain model, and that, for example, it precludes, you probably know very well that integrability in two dimensions, in any dimension, it precludes non-trivial scattering, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how can N equals Fourier-Mills theory possibly be integrable? It obviously has a non-trivial S matrix. So the point I want to emphasize is that when we say we want to solve it, we're not really talking about integrability in a very loose sense of the word. Solvability. What we really mean is solvability, in the sense that, is there some procedure for writing down the answers in a simple way to any quantity you might be interested in? And I think that one of the first pieces of evidence that shows us that we really are going to go beyond the planar limit is this BCJ work. So let me not say that non-planar Yang-Mills will be integrable, because I don't know what your preconceived notions of the word integrable are, but it seems apparent to me that there's going to be a machine, there's going to be a crank, that someone gives you a planar amplitude and there's an algebraic crank, you solve some equations, and boom, there's your non-planar amplitude. So that's an example of something that I consider solvability. So for the purpose of my talk, we're aiming for the moon. We're aiming for absolutely everything. So I'm, why not? Maybe it's too ambitious, but why not? It's often been the case in this field that something that seems outrageously ambitious, just a couple months later, turns out to be completely trivial.
Are you still going to say more about the non-perturbative?
I intentionally ducked non-perturbative as opposed to 1 over n. I will definitely talk about of course, you presumably mean non-perturbative and at finite n. Yeah. Because I will say more about non-perturbative, but at infinite n, and I have nothing to say, unfortunately, about non-perturbative at finite n. So let's see where we go. But I have nothing to say about that. Okay. Let's see. Any other questions?
I have a specific question.
Yeah.
So there are examples in two-dimensional physics where there's an integrable model and some transformation of it that actually has non-trivial
space. Yeah, absolutely, like matrix model.
And that's the way this works as well, because
absolutely,
what's integrable is not the four-dimensional field theory, it's some two-dimensional space.
Exactly, that's exactly the way it works here, yeah.
Do you have some more vision-type statement to say about this connection?
No, I don't. In fact, if I were to say more about this body of work, the body of work that has led up to the solution, I would say that it's not very well understood. I mean, the answer is known; it appears to be correct, but I think there are big open questions as to why it works and why the solution is the way it is. So I'm afraid I don't have much more to say about that. Okay, but mostly this was just meant to be part of a motivational seminar, and not really anything substantive. Okay, so then what is the frontier? And the frontier always gets pushed back, because when Witten's paper first came out, his paper on the twister string, he showed that MHV amplitudes, tree-level amplitudes, are supported in lines in twister space. And he gave some argument that non-MHV amplitudes would be supported on certain curves in twister space, et cetera, and he gave no explicit construction. So a naysayer might say, oh, this Witten's paper, that's really nice. Wake me up when they solve NMHV tree amplitudes, okay? So then shortly thereafter, NMHV tree amplitudes were solved and all tree level amplitudes. We had the CSW prescription and then BCFW. And then the naysayers could have said, okay, fine, you can get all gluon amplitudes or adjoint amplitudes. Show me something with quarks or with masses. Well, very soon all the technology was generalized. And then people started working on loop amplitudes, and we got one loop amplitudes in Super Yang-Mills theory. And then people, the naysayers, yawned and said, "Okay, well, wake me up when you can do one loop QCD." So then Svi Byrne and many people, but for example, Byrne and his collaborators had to go work on this black hat program, hopefully to try to appease the naysayers. But the frontier now, I really think, is this is the frontier in N equals 4. In N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, the frontier is non-trivial, I'll explain what that means as we go through the talk, multi-loop amplitudes. So the basic gist is the following. You know that you can write any amplitude as an integral over the loop momenta of some integrand. And the vast majority of the progress in the last several years has been developing radically new and for the most part efficient algorithms for generating these kinds of things by using various versions of generalized unitarity, maximal cuts, leading singularities, et cetera, et cetera. The basic idea is that this quantity here should be determined entirely in terms of tree-level data. So any advance you make in understanding the structure of tree-level amplitudes, like BCFW, for example, or CSW, feeds in automatically in helping you better understand and manipulate these objects. So I don't want to say that we're done completely understanding that part, but huge progress has been made. In contrast, there's been extremely little progress on this part of the problem. So basically, not only is it our field's ambition to make Michael's textbook obsolete, which admittedly we're very far from, we want to make Smirnoff's book obsolete. Smirnoff has a couple of books on evaluating Feynman integrals. He's one of the experts in that subject, of course, and we want to give him an early retirement for his own benefit so he can, go enjoy life rather than calculating five-loop non-planar diagrams. So we need a second revolution. I'm not going to provide it for you today, but hopefully I'll give you some hints that maybe something will be around the corner. Oops.
I think it's understandable that you're not here, because if you know the integrand, you know the integral. What do you mean?
Well, you know it in principle, but that's like saying that if you know the Feynman rules, you know any tree-level amplitude.
So it's a problem of integrating a function.
It's a problem of integrating a function. Yes, absolutely.
So the Russians or Eastern Europeans working in the field want a second revolution.
Okay. So in order to make progress, or in order to begin discussing the problem, we need some data. So this is another point that's been emphasized, that this is a very data-driven field, right? The difference between the S-matrix program of several decades ago and what we're doing today is back then, people had the idea, let's enumerate all the physical principles we want the S-matrix to have, analyticity, unitarity, et cetera, and then let's try to solve those constraints. Whereas the modern approach is, let's just try to get the answer by any means necessary, and then look at it and deduce its structure. And the reason that well, one of the reasons we've had more luck with this approach is because the answer often has things that you never would have guessed a priori. For example, dual conformal invariance in N equals 4 Young-Mills theory. I can't think of any reason a priori why you might have thought that the theory should have that symmetry until you started looking at results for loop amplitudes and seeing that it's there. So let's start with some data. Let's look at the 1 and 2 loop 4 particle amplitudes. Now it turns out that due to supersymmetry, or actually you can think about it in terms of dual conformal invariance, for 4 particle amplitudes, at all loop order, the amplitude is proportional to the tree level amplitude. That is, all of the helicity information factors out. So I can define this quantity to be the ratio. So the notation always is that a parenthetical superscript refers to a loop order, and a subscript refers to the number of particles. So what I can do, I can take the L loop 4 particle amplitude and divide it by the tree level 4 particle amplitude, which I remind you is just, let's say if I pick some helicities, it's 1, 2 cubed over 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 1, for example, if I've chosen particles 1 and 2 to have negative helicity. And the point is that this thing will be a function of S and T only. So all of the spinner weight, all of that factors out into this overall factor. So over here, I've written for you the result for the one loop amplitude. You can calculate it just by a single evaluating a single Feynman diagram. Well, I shouldn't call this a Feynman diagram. I mean, it is a Feynman diagram, but this is the result of summing up all the possible Feynman diagrams in N equals 4 Young-Mills theory. They magically collapse into just that one integral. And after you evaluate that integral, say in dimensional regularization, you get this nice hypergeometric function. And then, if you're so inclined, you might be interested to look at the expansion of that around 4 dimensions. So here I've written the first few terms. I factored out an overall factor to take care of the dimensions. And then here you get a power series expansion showing you all the epsilon poles and a rather non-enlightening and ever increasingly complicated linear combination of polylogarithm functions. I'll have much more to say about that later on, but that's what you get. Absolutely.
Is it a true statement that all loops print?
This? Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, and please continue.
Exponential or without exponential?
This is without this is literally just the one loop. The one loop amplitude. Any other questions?
What regularization scheme this does?
This is the four-dimensional helicity scheme.
Do you know that it is consistent to a loop order?
I don't know.
There was a reason for the
reason. No, the reason is because N equals 4 super Young-Mills. Remember, this is N equals 4. And we understand a lot about the algebra of how you sew the trees together. And if you do it explicitly, it's very clear there's no inconsistencies. Now, if you're going to theories with less supersymmetry, then in fact, things become a lot more confused and there are problems. So, but at least for N equals 4, I don't think there's any chance. Maybe there's no proof, but
I wouldn't worry about it. Either, so.
But in any case, I write this formula this way on the board to try to make it most comfortable for most of the people in the audience. But dimensional regularization is not our favorite regulator.
Where is your Compton constant?
Well, okay, there's an overall, I factored out on front. So there's an overall factor of the coupling constant. Yeah, so we in n equals 4, we're starting to make a transition to the point where we prefer to use a regulator that manifestly preserves dual conformal invariants, which dimensional regularization obviously does not, because it moves you away from four dimensions. So we don't like formulas like this anymore, but in order to try to provide some notion of familiarity to those in the audience, I've written it in DIMREG. Okay, any other questions?
What's the alternative regularization?
I'm sorry? Basically you Higgs the theory. So you break from UN to UN minus 1 cross U1, so you give one of the W bosons a mass, and that mass gives you that mass regulates the infrared divergences.
And then you have to do calculations with a finite mass.
The finite mass. If you have any planar diagram, the mass only enters the propagators on the outside of the loop. No, it's not a trick. Absolutely, it's not a trick. I have to explain the limit in more detail, because it really amounts to breaking UN down to UN minus M times UM, and then taking a certain scaling limit as N and M go to infinity. You can show that the dominant diagrams are all of this type, where the internal lines are all massless, and the mass, the only mass is on the external lines.
So you larger limit, you preserve conformal and
you preserve. That's right. But what I'm going to do in just a moment is do the infrared subtraction and find manifest finite quantities. Any well-defined finite quantity should be independent of your regularization scheme. So let's just get to that. So here's the point. I'm not going to write for you the two-loop amplitude. Now I'm going to need some blackboard space.
You said one and two loop four particle amplitudes up there, but for any loop.
This was a general comment, and then what I want to do now is look at the one loop and the two loop amplitude. Anastasio, Byrne, Dixon, and Kossower calculated the two loop amplitude, and I'm not going to write it for you on the board, but they found something remarkable. Well, some of this formula is not remarkable. Some of it is very well known. But I'll point out the part which is remarkable in just a second. Okay, they found this relation where I haven't defined div 2. Let me move over here. How do I want to do this? Let me do it here. I think I even tried to get all the factors of 2 correct, but I can't absolutely promise. You can put a mu square there if you want to put in a scale. Okay, so let me. Most of you know this. So the basic idea is, it's of course very well known that when you form this combination, okay, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to take the logarithm of the amplitude, infrared singularities in this massless gauge theories exponentiate. So these divergent terms are the terms which, you know, were known due to analysis by many other people prior to ABDK. The surprising thing, and the apparently non-trivial thing about the ABDK relation, is that what's left over here, the finite term, and maybe I should put plus order epsilon. Plus order epsilon. The finite term here is remarkably simple. So the basic, because the point is, I didn't write down the two-loop amplitude, but if you calculate the two-loop amplitude, at finite order, it involves things like Li4. I didn't mention it, but these Ln functions are the polylog functions, which generalize the Dye logarithm that Kossauer talked about. So this the two-loop amplitude here involves Li4 and other complicated functions of similar weight, as does this term. You see, because when you square the one-loop amplitude has a 1 over epsilon squared pole. And so when you square this thing, there's a finite contribution due to a cross term from that 1 over epsilon squared pole hitting this epsilon squared. And that cross term gives you Li4s and other garbage, like Li3 times log x and dot, dot, dot. So magically, when you take this linear combination, not only do you reproduce the divergent terms that you have to just on the general field theory grounds, but what's left over is remarkably simple, just log squared s over t plus 2 pi squared over 3. So a priori, you could have expected a much more complicated function there. And in general, in other theories, not in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, you do have much more complicated dependence there. Any questions?
How would you get the Li4 in the Higgs regulator?
You could have it there, absolutely. You just have Li4 of S over T.
So you
can get
it in the
No. Okay, good question. Sorry. You're absolutely right. In this so-called Higgs regulator, 1 over epsilon turns into log m squared. So every amplitude becomes a polynomial in log m squared. And I don't remember exactly. I'm ashamed because I've even worked it out myself. I don't remember how the cancellation works, but when you form this combination, you get a similar divergent term where you have log squared m squared, log m squared, finite, and then you get the same thing here. But I don't remember how the cancellation works out.
You never order m squared terms.
Exactly. So that's one of the main benefits.
And the most complex part.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this is one of the reasons why we love this mass regulator so much, because you never have to worry about these higher order terms. It can't be there. Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember, but you're convincing me it can't be there. Any other questions? Okay, so the remarkable thing, well, if that weren't remarkable enough, is that this pattern continues. So Byrne, Dixon, and Smirnoff computed this thing. Okay, so first of all, you get divergent terms. Let me just go ahead and write the general answer. So basically what happens is there are some coefficients here that appear at each loop order. Let me call them AL over epsilon squared, BL over epsilon plus CL. So the L loop divergent, these divergent pieces, of course, come from the wedges.
Divergent doesn't strictly mean
Oh, good point. So, no. Maybe you're asking what motivated me to include this finite piece. I'll come back to that in a second. You're right. It's ambiguous. There's a reason why we chose this precisely, which I'll discuss in a minute. But you're right. I could have absorbed this into there, but this particular combination plays an important role.
Left, you mean M4 2 times M4 1 in the second term?
Or yes, 1 times 2. Thank you. Okay, so at each loop order, you get a similar structure, just the numerical constants here change a little bit. minus s over mu squared to the minus l epsilon. And then the finite piece is plus 11 pi to the fourth over 180 times the same thing. Okay, and the one loop amplitude can also be written in that form for a suitable choice of these numerical constants. So this was the result of ABDK, Anastasio, Berndixen, and Kossover. This was the result of Berndixen and Smirnov. And they conjectured that this pattern holds to all loop order. OK, so what is precisely the conjecture? What I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply these equations by appropriate powers of a coupling constant. Let me call it A. So take A times this equation. Add it to a squared times this equation. Add it to a cubed times this equation. And add them all up. So the left-hand side sums up to the logarithm of 1 plus the sum ai, well, let me call it alml4. And the right-hand side sums up to, let me just call it, you know what, I have too many A's. Okay. Okay, so basically you sum up all of these divergent pieces into something that depends on your coupling constant A. And on S or T, there's a 2 here. And then the last terms sum up to, and this is really the important point, a very well-known function f of lambda called the cusp anomalous dimension. Oh yeah, sorry. Cusp anomalous dimension log squared S over T plus 2 pi squared over 3. So again, a priori, you know, when you go to 3, 4, 5 loops, et cetera, you could have, and in a general gauge theory you do, expect much more complicated functional dependence here. At 10 loop order, you could have expected polylogarithms of weight 20. So the BDS Ansatz conjectured that, in fact, all that cancels out, and the finite piece always takes this very simple form. And moreover, they conjectured that a similar story happens for any n, not just for the four-particle amplitude. But I'll say more about that shortly. Are there any questions about the statement of the F is the cusp anomalous dimension.
Yeah, I know, but somehow this is a limit where those are the leading singularities. And like the coefficients in diff A are
also. Yeah, the leading one is related very simply, of course, to the cusp anomalous dimension. This is related to something that's sometimes called the collinear anomalous dimension. And I still haven't discussed, as promised, what motivates the inclusion of this constant, but that's more naturally discussed a little bit later. And by the way, I should have said this, of course, thanks to the work of the integrability community, in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, we know the cusp anomalous dimension exactly, not just perturbatively to all orders, but there's an integral equation it satisfies. You give me any finite coupling, you can calculate it numerically, as far as you have the patience to do so. So this thing is known exactly. Any other questions?
Yeah. wanted to comment to.
Yeah.
When you go to this Rayleigh limit, there's an interesting property of this amplitude, which is very exact.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask you if this is a direct consequence of dual conformal invariance.
Indeed. I don't know the direct connection between dual conformal invariance and Regi exactness, but indeed this is a consequence of dual conformal invariance that I'll show shortly. I don't know if there's a more direct connection between, so dual conformal invariance requires that this has to be true, as I'll show you, but I don't know if there's a more direct connection with Regi exactness. Okay, so this is the kind of thing, when you've got a conjecture like that, BDS made, it is known, I'll even put quotes on that for this audience, that if you go to strong coupling, and now I'm going to switch conventions and call this the coupling constant, specifically the Tolf coupling. Lambda is G Yang Mills squared N in the large N limit where lambda is kept finite. Okay, so we know from ADS-CFT that if you take lambda to infinity, the cusp anomalous dimension behaves like square root lambda. So the BDS prediction is that A of lambda over A tree is like the exponential of some IR divergent piece plus square root lambda over a pi, log squared s over t, plus constant. And by constant, I mean it can depend on lambda. So I'm now neglecting. This is the part I'm going to be most interested in. I'm not so worried about things like plus pi squared, etc. So this constant means it can be a function of lambda, but not a function of S or T. All the kinematic dependence is right here.
Sorry, this BDS conjecture is for planar limit or?
Absolutely. And I should have said this, the conjecture was only for MHV amplitudes. Of course, here, because I was talking about the four particle amplitude, it was automatically MHV. Okay. What does one do when there's a strong coupling prediction? Well, Juan goes and tests it by his ADS-CFT. So I want to just say a couple of words about what Alde and Maldacena did. At strong coupling. And let me emphasize again, I'm sort of giving a historical overview. We now know that this formula for the four-particle amplitude is exact, completely true, all orders in perturbation theory, non-perturbably, it's correct. But I want to explain the check that Alde and Maldacena did the summer of 2007 to check that this is indeed correct to leading order in the large lambda limit. And what they did was they showed, well, remember that ADS-CFT says that n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory is equivalent to string theory on ADS-5 cross S-5. And you can think of anti-Visser space like a cylinder. And the prescription, I'm really not going to say much detail about this, but I'm going to explain the prescription for calculating scattering amplitudes at strong coupling via ADS-CFT. So the idea is you draw a polygon on the boundary remember that the gauge theory sort of lives on the boundary of this anti-de Sitter 5 space, the boundary of this cylinder. So you draw a polygon on the boundary with edges P1, P2, up to Pn. By momentum conservation, you get a closed curve. Okay, so they're all light-like, of course. So this is time. So I tried to draw something here where you know, each leg is at a 45 degree angle because they're all light-like. So this would be an example for a what? 8 particle amplitude. So you draw a polygon on the boundary of this cylinder, and the polygon is specified by the momenta of the particles that you want to scatter. And what you do is you find a minimal area surface. Let me now do projection. It's harder to draw, so let me sort of project. This plane I now imagine as the boundary of that cylinder, and this area will be the interior. So you have some polygon here, and you look for minimal area surface inside ADS space that ends on that polygon, as if you were making a wireframe, you know, out of bending pieces of wire, and you're looking for a soap bubble that spans that wireframe. And the criterion for our soap bubble is not that it should minimize surface area in R3, like a real soap bubble does, but that it should minimize surface area in ADS5, in this hyperbolic space. So this is supposed to...
So you're saying we should be thinking about the boundary as the dual conformal coordinate x inside the...
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah, because so if this were x1, say, and this were x2, and this were x3, then x2 minus x1 would be p1, etc.
So it's not the I don't know what I should say, the original ADS-CFT picture, in the sense that...
Yes, exactly. I didn't explain where this prescription came from, and one of the steps here involves a t-duality. And the t-duality involves exchanging string winding number and string momentum, worldsheet winding number and momentum. And so what happens is that instead of having string vertex operators localized at the insertion points, they sort of become delocalized after this t-duality, and the string vertex operators actually live on these segments where the momentum has now turned into a, quote, winding number, meaning the endpoints are separated. But I don't want to say much more about this, but yes, that was a good observation that this is a little, it looks different, and the reason it looks different is because there's a t-duality hiding inside here. But this is the prescription. You want to calculate a scattering amplitude, you draw this polygon, and you find the area of that minimal area surface to leading order for large lambda. So then, at large lambda, the scattering amplitude should behave like exponential of the, well, there's a square root lambda times the area of the minimal surface, spanning your polygon. Okay, so if you could define, you can write a coordinate system on ADS5 by realizing it as a hyperboloid embedded in a higher dimensional space of signature 2, 2. So here I've got 6 coordinates subject to a quadratic constraint, and the resulting 5-dimensional subspace of that 6-dimensional space is a parametrization of ADS5. And I just want to briefly show you what the solution looks like. I'm then going to switch coordinates again to something that looks slightly more familiar. These are called Poincaré coordinates. And then, so the point is, Alde and Malacena were able to find an exact solution describing the embedding of this bubble for the case of four particles. Actually, maybe I should have written this formula on the board. They all have the same denominator, so I'm going to skip that. And it turns out their solution actually lives. These are supposed to be Z's. Oh, these are U's. Yeah, I'm sorry. I just have two coordinates, U1 and U2. I'm trying to parametrize a surface. So on my surface, I have, let's say, U1 and U2. So as U1, let me specify, U1 and U2 range from minus infinity to infinity. And as you let them range from minus infinity to infinity, they cover this surface. Okay, I'm not quite done explaining all this. But one interesting thing, their solution happens to not make use of the fourth coordinate. So it lives entirely inside an ADS4 subspace. But that's fine. If you had more than four particles, there would be no way to fit them all in an ADS4 subspace. Well, except in very special kinematic points. In general, they would fill out the full ADS5. I just want to briefly show you why this has the desired properties. Look at U1 goes to plus infinity. So first of all, notice, I didn't specify it here, but r, in these coordinates, r is the distance away from this plane. So we can ask, where does this surface touch the boundary of ADS? Well, it touches the boundary whenever r is equal to 0. Where does r equal 0? Well, there are four different ways r can be 0. U1 can go to plus or minus infinity, or U2 can go to plus or minus infinity. So in fact, these four lines here, one of them would be the line U1 equals plus infinity, one of them would be U2 equals plus infinity, one of them would be U1 equals minus infinity, and the other would be U2 equals minus infinity.
How do you get from the polygon to the four lines?
Let me just look at a four-point amplitude. Yeah, this is called the four-cusp solution. Because it has four cusps. So if you, for example, go to U1 equals plus infinity, then R is 0. Z0 is A square root 1 plus B squared tanh U2 over 1 plus B tanh U2. Z1 is A over 1 plus B tanh U2. And Z2 is A tanh U2 over 1 plus B tanh U2.
Carefully, you might note that this happens to be bringing together four. or single?
Absolutely. So Kruchensky earlier had a solution describing a single cusp. Well, actually two. There was a hidden one at infinity. And basically, Alde and Malasena got this solution by a clever rotation And I should comment that no explicit solutions are known for more than four cusps. I'll say a little more about that later.
Is it clear that the solution is unique?
Is it the unique? I don't know. Certainly, you can check that it's a saddle point of the action. I don't know. Intuitively, I can't see how it could possibly be non-unique. There's nothing so pathological about ADS space that would let you have two differently shaped bubbles, but I don't know, that's just an intuition.
Once the number of legs grows larger, you can actually show that there have to be.
Oh yeah, absolutely, good point, yeah.
A and B?
A and B, so this is a two-parameter family. This is a two-parameter family. And what I'm going to do in just a second is relate A and B to S and T. So if you take the limit U1 goes to plus infinity, you can see that this parameterizes a light-like line from y1 equals y2 equals a over 1 plus b. You see, now this is parameterizing a line because you just have one variable, u2. So as u2 goes to plus infinity, you get, you get z1 equals z2 equals a over 1 plus b. But if u2 goes to minus infinity, you get z1 equals z2 equals a over 1 minus b. And it's not, they write in the paper that it's supposed to be obvious that this is a light-like line. Indeed, you can check in about a minute that it is, but it is a light-like line. So you can check the other boundaries as well. So all four of the boundaries here are indeed light-like lines. So this is exactly the solution you're looking for. And all you have to do is translate between the parameters A and B and S and T. Basically, what the solution looks like is something like this. Okay, so the way to think about this is imagine the blackboard is now the boundary of ADS space. But yeah, remind me never to change notation from somebody's paper to my talk. Okay. The boundary is a 3 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space. I've drawn two spatial dimensions. So what's happening here is that the third coordinate is inert. It's 0. Imagine for the moment that time goes into the board. So you should imagine that all four of these are light-like line segments that sort of start here above the board, plunge into the board to reach that point, then come out of the board at a 45-degree angle, because it has to be light-like, to reach this point, then plunge into the board again, and then plunge back out of the board. So each of these is a light-like line segment on the boundary of this anti-de Sitter space. Are there any questions about this solution? OK, so what they did then was to evaluate the area. Now, the problem is that this is, of course, a divergent area because the volume of anti-de Sitter space, or anything that reaches the, both the volume and the surface area of anything reaching the boundary here have infinite are infinite. So they had to introduce a cutoff, and then they had to translate that cutoff to what in gauge theory we call dimensional regularization. But they were able to identify in a precise way how to match the two regularization schemes, because after all, this is a finite, well-defined quantity that has to be the same as long as, no matter how you regulate, as long as you do it right. And they found exactly that answer. They verified BBS for 4-point. Are there any questions about this? Okay, so let me just say a couple words about the status. Okay, good, yes.
This doesn't concern the diff terms, right?
Well, they also reproduced exactly the divergent terms. So the divergences for them also come exactly from these cusps, and they reproduced exactly these. The only thing that was slightly non-trivial is that they had to invent a way to do dimensional regularization in ADS-CFT. And what they did, they went to ADS-5 plus epsilon cross S5 minus epsilon.
What I'm confused about, I mean, then you also need the coefficient function in the diff terms in the large coupling unit.
Oh yeah. So exactly. Well, they knew. So the first term there is the cusp anomalous dimension. The first term, you know, it's because it's related to cusp anomalous dimension. The second term is related to this collinear anomalous dimension. So in fact, by looking at their answer, they made a prediction for what the collinear anomalous dimension is at strong coupling, etc. So that's how to interpret their result.
So the geometrical interpretation is that the diagonals of this one is S and one is D.
Oh, exactly. Thank you. I was about to skip that point. But there's some relation. I think if you work it out exactly, this is like square root of minus s, and this is square root of minus t. But there's some precise relation I won't write down. That so a and b translate into s and t. So depending on the shape of this, you get a different area, and the finite piece of that area is exactly this. Yes? No, absolutely not.
It's not possible to see if it matches this.
No, there's no independent strong coupling check. Yeah, that would be an interesting.
Did they also prove the exponentiation?
No, because their result is only strictly at strong coupling. So the BDS ansatz is that, you know, it exponentiates at any coupling or at each loop order, but their result is only a strictly strong coupling.
But the answer is e to the area. So it's,
yeah, the answer is e to the area, so the e is automatically there, yeah. So what is the state of the art? It's large lambda.
And for the area.
I'm sorry? The area, so the area, you know, after you've regulated it, this is basically the area. So if you would go beyond four particles, it's difficult or impossible to find analytic solutions describing these soap bubbles. And maybe that's okay, because after all, what you care about is not the exact solution, but you care about the areas. And there's been some very powerful mathematical technology developed by people like Alde, Gaiato, and Maldacena that applies certain ideas from integrability to allow you to calculate those areas. So the state of the art now is that there's a paper called the Y system for scattering amplitudes. I think I also forgot to mention. There's a paper called the Y system for scattering amplitudes where they write down a set of equations that, in principle, if you give me the data that specify any polygon, so you give me the scattering data, there's a system of equations you can solve to calculate the area of the minimal area world sheet. Now, they're hard to solve analytically. There are some special cases I'll talk about in a moment, but you can, in principle, do it numerically, for example, to get strong coupling predictions for scattering amplitudes. Now, I'm already past time, so I just have one more couple of comments. Because it was hard to solve in general, the BDS-Ansatz was in trouble, however, because of large n. So what Alday and Malvicena were able to do is to calculate a polygon with a very large number of tiny sides that approximates some smooth Wilson loop, like a circular Wilson loop, or depending on what coordinate system you're in. So they were able to calculate the area of this object in the limit of large n. Now, little n, big N, the number of colors is always large. And they found that there was a problem that the BDS-Ansatz didn't appear to be hold for large N. And so if you ask the question, it appears to hold for N equals 4, but not large N. So what's going on?
Which part does not hold?
In their case, it boiled down to, it was really a tiny effect that they got literally the wrong plus constant behavior. So there are some plus constant terms here that I've been ignoring. And some of those plus constant terms come with an N in front of them. And other ones don't come with an N in front of them. And when they did this calculation at strong coupling, they were sensitive to the part of those constants that have an N in front of them, and they got the wrong numerical result. So it had nothing to do with Pauli logarithms or anything like that, because the way their calculation was set up, it was such a simple kinematic setup that it wasn't sensitive to that level of detail. It was literally only sensitive to this constant. But still, they found the wrong constant, so that it had to be wrong.
And maybe it should also be said that Lopatov noticed that starting from 6 particles, you have the wrong analyticity properties, for reasons that were explained to us on Monday.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, of course. Yes, so it also, there were signs of trouble from that point of view.
It's very important. It's not signs of trouble. It's very important because it attacks the exponentiation answer.
Yeah. So it was known to be wrong. Yes.
Yeah, the strong coupling could be related to the subtle Pauli approximation.
Exactly. Maybe there were other subtleties, right? Or maybe ADS-CFT is wrong. Thanks for pointing that out. Okay, so what is the explanation and what's going on here? I promised to explain that it all boils down to dual conformal invariants. Remember that dual conformal invariants acts by inverting these x coordinates, which are given by differences of momenta, or in terms of which differences of momenta are written. If you believe, it's now known to be true, but at that time, if you were willing to make the hypothesis that dual conformal invariance was an exact symmetry, dual conformal invariance implies that the amplitude must satisfy a certain Ward identity. You see, the dual conformal invariance is broken by the infrared divergences, but broken in a very controllable, exactly controllable way. And that is encoded in what we call the dual conformal Ward identity, whose solution So I skipped an important step here, which is that the historical motivation for this was that people were starting to realize that, see the point here is that suppose you wanted to calculate a Wilson loop at strong coupling. You would do exactly this calculation. If I wanted to know the expectation value of the path-ordered exponential going around this curve, this polygon, I would calculate the exponential of that area. So after Alde and Malacena's paper, people said, well, hey, that's really neat. At strong coupling, calculating an amplitude and calculating a Wilson loop in the dual space are exactly the same thing. Could it be that at weak coupling, that's also true? No way. But of course, it turned out that it was true, that people, by laborious calculation, one loop, two loop, started observing empirically that loop by loop order, the expectation value of a Wilson loop on this polygon was exactly equal to the scattering amplitude. So the step in the argument I skipped was that once you believe that there's a connection between Wilson loops and amplitudes, so strictly speaking, it's the Wilson loop that satisfies the dual conformal Ward identity. Because the Wilson loop lives in X space, where what we call dual conformal invariance is literally the ordinary conformal invariance. So the ordinary Ward identity that the Wilson loop satisfies because of the divergences at its cusps becomes, when you translate it to the amplitude, the dual conformal Ward identity. And you know, it sounds like this is all built upon a series of conjectures, and historically it certainly was the case. Now all these conjectures are proven, but the history was totally jumbled as people tried to wade their way through this mess. And the solution to the dual conformal Ward identity is in planar gauge theory, all of the divergences come from the adjacent two-particle kinematics, from the wedges here. So the dual conformal Ward identity is a differential equation that has an inhomogeneous term. And so when you solve it, you get a part that's fixed. There's a particular inhomogeneous solution. And that particular inhomogeneous solution is exactly, well, for the four-particle amplitude, it's exactly that thing. Log squared s over t. And then you could have, in general, a homogeneous solution. Let me say a possible homogeneous solution. So a homogeneous solution has to be anything, or could be anything, that is a function only of dual conformal cross ratios. So what is a cross ratio? A cross ratio is something like xi minus xj squared xk minus xl squared over xi minus xk squared xj minus xl squared. So this is invariant under dual conformal transformations. So once you're willing to believe the hypothesis of dual conformal invariance, the BDS ansatz is fixed to take this form, where this is the quantity had long been known. It hadn't long been known that it was the solution of the Ward identity, but it turned out it was, plus possibly a homogeneous solution. Now here's where the real point comes from. The real point is, for n equals 4 and 5, there are no cross ratios. Right? Because all of your points are light-like separated from their nearest neighbor. If you only have 4 points, there's no way you can make a quantity like this. Inevitably, one of these 4 things is going to be 0. There's no non-trivial cross ratio. Similarly for 5 points. The first non-trivial cross ratio are things like at the 6 particle amplitude, x1 minus x3, 4 squared, x2 minus x5 squared, over x1 minus x5 squared, x2 minus x4 squared. So there are actually 3 of them given by cyclic permutations of that quantity. First non-trivial cross ratio at n equals 6. So I'm already over time, so I hope I'm not rushing too much. But the modern understanding is that the reason why the BDS-Ansatz works, has to work, for 4 and, I didn't mention this, but also 5 particles, is because this part is completely fixed by the dual conformal Ward identity. And then here, there's nothing. Maybe you could imagine having plus constant here. And this goes back to Aaron's question from long ago, but the convention in the literature is to always absorb into this divergent piece a particular constant chosen so that anything left over here has to vanish in all collinear limits. So for 4 and 5 points, you could imagine putting plus constant here. That would be dual conformal invariant, but the only constant that vanishes in all collinear limits is the constant 0. I feel like I'm channeling Sidney Coleman now. But so for 4 and 5 points, this explains the BDS-Ansatz. Are there any questions about this?
Yeah, I want to point out that the fact that the amplitude is very exact, so you can take the limit, that gives you the same answer as the full answer.
Okay.
It's also true for the 5 point amplitude.
Yeah, yeah.
The 4 and the 5.
Yeah.
It's only, this doesn't happen when you go to the 6.
Right.
And that little freedom that you have when you take the limit is what they allowed the Del Duca, Smirnoff, to really simplify
the triple coin. Yeah.
To only, what, 17
pages. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then to go to your
That's right. So, but do you think there's a direct connection? I mean, so.
There's a direct connection. I think it'd be. My opinion, any questions by Amils, at least in the lowest orders, in the lowest number of legs, is driven by this Regis divisor theorem. The differences start up here only at 6 points.
Yeah. So I hope I've motivated.
Can you comment a little bit more on this collinear limit?
Oh.
Because, I mean, it's sort of like, and that's really crucial.
It's crucial, yeah.
To saying that any 485.
But see, the I motivated this by saying that the structure of infrared singularities is very well understood in arbitrary massless gauge theories. The structure of collinear singularities are also pretty well understood. And I'm certainly not the right person to speak about this, but it is possible to choose the first two terms here in such a way that not only is any remainder that you can possibly add here finite, but also you can absorb stuff into here so that by definition anything you add has to vanish in all collinear limits. If that sounds very non-trivial to you, maybe the experts can discuss it.
There are limits in this respect corresponds to reducing the number of points, so you want to have consistency between n and n minus 1.
In this picture, collinear limit would be reducing an n gon to an n minus 1 gon by letting 2 adjacent lines become. Okay, so the first non-trivial amplitude, you know, so with the modern understanding, the first non-trivial multi-loop amplitude is the 2-loop, 6-particle amplitude. And so this quantity here is called the remainder function. far. The remainder function is a highly, so first of all, it's finite by construction, and it's dual conformal invariant. So it's a function of the three conformal cross ratios only, and is definitely a non-zero, non-trivial function of the U's. It was first calculated numerically in a collaboration with Byrne, Dixon, Kossauer, Radu, Anastasia, and Vergu, and myself. We calculated it numerically at a few points. And you know, see, I have to thank you, because when we were checking our formula that I'm about to explain, we had to scour the literature for data that had been numerically evaluated in various kinematic regimes. And there was one kinematic regime where there was only a single data point in the literature. And it was in our paper, and it was a kinematic point that you had chosen. So without that, you know, we would have been screwed. Okay, so this is a non-trivial function, and I have a lot of negative time left, but in a heroic effort, Del Duca, Dur, and Smirnov evaluated this function analytically as a 17-page linear combination of generalized polylogarithm functions. And it really was a heroic computation, but obviously our thinking was that if that's the best you can do for the simplest non-trivial amplitude in Soubriant-Mills theory, we should just all give up and quit now. So the 30-second synopsis of our paper is that we use some fancy mathematics from the theory of motives to simplify their formula. I know it sounds unsexy to spend several months simplifying someone's formula, but we managed to go from 17 pages down to a single line, which was kind of cool. I won't write the single line formula in general on the board, but in the special case where you have a regular polygon, U1 equals U2, a regular hexagon, here's what it looks like. I've written it for you on the board. I know, yeah, no, it's surprising that you can actually, there's no considerable simplification when you set all the points equal. I might have as well, in fact, I would have been better off just writing the general formula. It assembles a little bit more nicely, actually. But, and then it depends on whether you're talking about one line in the blackboard or one line in tech. But there it is. 95% of the work that went into our formula is unpublished and remains untalked about, because we only get to this stage when we're 25 minutes past the end of our talk. So history will never record how much blood and sweat went into this. There was once, so those of you who have heard about symbols know that symbols fix for you the functional form of something, but they don't tell you the branch cut structure. This thing has a nasty branch cut structure. Inside the square root is a 1 minus u squared. That's a fancy way of writing absolute value of 1 minus u. If you don't have absolute value of 1 minus u there, this formula is wrong. What's shocking is that this formula is infinitely differentiable for all positive u. It looks absurd because there's this absolute value of 1 minus u. How can this be infinitely differentiable? It is. We spent 1 month, there was a 1 month period when we had the complete formula, except that its third derivative was discontinuous on a certain slice in U space. We had a formula with the right symbol, it was real valued everywhere. We started plotting it, we weren't quite sure, we zoomed in, we plotted the first derivative, it starts looking a little strange, plotted the second derivative, plotted the third derivative, it was discontinuous. So a month just went into fixing those kinds of subtleties. But this formula absolutely is infinitely differentiable, as it has to be. Okay, but enough about that. My conclusion was, what was my
Because the thing you mean, the problematic
The problematic things. I didn't write here for you all of the log to the fourth terms, but they also involve some. Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to end with a motivational comment, because I began with a motivational comment that I think the importance of this formula. See, when you when people do really, really hard QCD calculations, they do it because you actually need to know the answer. Someone at the LHC is going to measure something and they need to know your answer. For us, I couldn't care less about the value of the two-loop six-particle MHV amplitude in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory. Nobody cares about it. I mean, nobody cares about the value of the formula. The reason we care about it is to understand the structure of the result. And if the structure were hidden in 17 pages of generalized polylogarithms, there's nothing you can do with it. So I think the value of having formulas like this is that you can start to get your mind around it, and it's only when you have something that you can get your mind around can you start having the hope of understanding things to higher order. And I wanted to say, there's a strong coupling prediction. You can calculate this thing at strong coupling via the Y system I talked about. It looks like R of lambda is square root lambda times minus 3/8 log squared u minus 3/4 Li2 of u minus, this is a rather unpleasant term, you could write it in terms of logs if you want, inverse cosine, which of course you can write in terms of logs, but that's what it is. So this is the simplest non-trivial scattering amplitude, and we know it now leading order at weak coupling and at strong coupling. And you might think it's crazy to hope that just knowing two data points, the leading order at weak coupling and the leading order at strong coupling, is enough to get us anywhere. But the history of our subject, for example, the history of the success of the anomalous dimension speaks otherwise. I just looked it up this morning. It was exactly 2.5 years between knowing the three-loop cusp anomalous dimension in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory and knowing the exact answer to all orders. So here's a function. We know its leading behavior at strong coupling, and we know its first non-zero term at weak coupling. And I'll bet you any number of bottles of wine that within the not-too-distant future we'll know the answer, or at least we'll have simple methods of computing this and other related quantities to any order.
And dimension numerically somehow?
This and this?
Yeah.
Well, there's no reason. Well, there were some interesting papers exploring that, but there's no reason to expect they should match, because this is expected to be a non-trivial function of the coupling constant, which interpolates between weak and strong coupling. So there's no priori. Some people plotted them, and actually they look very similar, R of lambda will be a complicated function of four variables, lambda u1, u2, u3, that interpolates between this and this. Okay, so I think I've already gone way over time, but I hope that I've given you a little bit of a motivational seminar and also a little bit of an explanation of the state of where we are as far as understanding the connection between weak coupling and strong coupling of scattering amplitudes. So thank you.
Any questions?
More questions?
Yeah. A very short question. You commented on the triality. So you had three things that you talked about here, the scattering amplitudes and the Wilson loops. How do the correlation functions in your context enter into this?
That's sort of the newest leg of the triality. So it just turns out that there's a particular set of correlation functions you can calculate that produce for you automatically L-loop integrands or even L-loop amplitudes if you want to go ahead and integrate them. But I don't know if there's a nice, this is a very beautiful picture for understanding the connection between a scattering amplitude on the boundary of ADS and some Wilson loop. I don't yet know if there's, maybe someone else can comment, but I don't yet have a nice intuitive physical picture for the correlation function part of the story. But it's also the newest connection.
You mentioned also it's lifelike, the coordinates on the correlation function are chosen in a lifelike way. That's where this triality holds.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you calculate a correlation function with operators inserted sort of at these corners that are lifelike separated from each other. So it's not totally disjoint picture, but
Yeah, two things. I wonder whether it's known whether all endpoint amplitudes behave like square root lambda.
Basically.
And second thing is, in the beginning when Sweden marked that it's all planar, you dismissed it in a sense, but now it is all planar.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. No, here everything is absolutely planar. And in the beginning of the talk, which David Gross fortunately missed so that he couldn't harass me, I waxed philosophically about how we're going to solve everything, including non-planar. But absolutely everything in my talk after that speculation was planar. Yeah.
Are you solving non-planar?
Yeah.
Of course, you got to stop the
Yeah.
Let me make just a remark. As far as I understand, the first analytic calculation of the finite remainder was the one done by Bartels, Lipatov, and myself in a certain kinematical limit.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry.
The first analytic expression. And then it turns out that your calculation, which is fantastic, agrees with
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
Absolutely perfect.
Absolutely,
There's
yeah.
There's a paper by Schallinger where numerically he took all the exact results for the 6-point amplitude at two loops, and it agreed again. So we work, okay, we have to go to, all we have to do is to take an analytic continuation of what it was known.
Right.
See, there was a problem. There was a beginning of the regicat.
Yeah.
But it was only the beginning, not the full regicat.
Yeah.
We were able to reconstruct the full regicat due to this now not so fashionable 60s techniques of analytic symmetric. But we knew this contribution, how to calculate them.
Absolutely.
And now this is how can this help now? Because now you can go very far with these exact expressions. But in this limit that you were calculating. For example, one can go to these kinematical regions and make an all order prediction.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you. I was
compared to the strong pattern.
Absolutely, I was going to say that, but cut myself off for lack of time. So thank you. Yeah, there's very little data in the literature on this function at other values of the coupling, but you and your group have, well, Juan's group also has some data about the near collinear limit, but your group from the consideration, yeah, that's basically the only data in the literature we have at this point. Yes.
So, just intuitively, I guess, could you explain a little better why logarithms, and especially dilogarithms and multilogarithms, appear on the strong coupling side when you solve these minimal errors?
Oh, I don't have a good sense for why they appear on strong coupling. See, for those of you familiar with the concept of transcendentality, you know that order by order, everything has a certain weight. Like in this epsilon coefficient, everything has weight 3, Li3, log times Li2, log cubed.
But logarithms appear in Feynman integrals. But why are dilogarithms?
I don't know. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that this doesn't have uniform transcendentality because here's something of degree 2 divided by pi. I know that doesn't address your question, but so. And I should say, it's very likely that this was a very special case. This was the symmetric hexagon. No one has analytically evaluated the general hexagon at strong coupling, and I'm at the stage where actually I would be surprised if it involved only polylogarithm functions. I would suspect it would involve more complicated functions. So I think some of this, the fact that you're seeing logs and Li2s, is because we only have very limited set of data. Those are the functions we know best how to calculate with. But if the true answer for arbitrary use will probably be some crazy function.
But to get the result, there is a heavy use of integrality, no? Because they use this Y system.
This is from the Y system, absolutely.
So it's related to the integrality of the...
Yeah. But I don't know if there's any connection between integrability and Li functions, is there? Yeah. In fact, I mean, for those of you who are interested, the most amazing thing, I no longer think it's true. I was saying this, someone should go evaluate this integral. This arose in discussions with Arkani Hamed. This contributes to the two-loop n cubed MHV amplitude in Super Yang-Mills theory, and we suspect that this integral will not be expressible in terms of a polylogarithm and generalized polylogarithm functions. This will involve elliptic functions, which is good news because in certain QCD calculations, it's known that there are elliptic functions that appear if you have sufficiently many masses on internal lines. Here we don't have any masses because we're still in n equals 4, but the masses are effectively provided because all the corners are massive. So we suspect this will give you an elliptic integral, which is great news because because, you know, I gave this speech at the beginning how the naysayers always say, oh, you can only do this or you can only do that. Well, the next step is the naysayers will say, oh, you can only solve any generalized polylogarithm, you can't solve elliptic functions. But because elliptic functions appear in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, we're going to solve them too.
So cosine is a degeneration of an elliptic function.
It's maybe a degeneration, yeah, yeah. I prefer to think about it as a logarithm, but you're right, maybe it's a degenerate. And there's an infinite class. I think I can draw Feynman diagrams. So if polylogs are sort of the first level, elliptic functions are the next, I mean, there's a whole infinite class of more and more complicated functions that probably appear in generic kinematics at strong coupling. I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you take the Guntra formula and you replace some of the rational functions with things that have square roots in the denominators, like sort of an arbitrary number of them, why do you need to? Anything more complicated than that?
Anything more complicated than elliptic functions?
Well, this sort of generalized function that has a Guntra representation with multiple square roots in the denominators.
Right, but how do you know that square roots are the worst you'll get? What about cube roots?
I mean, square roots show up because you start out with things that have, I mean, it's clear with masses.
Yeah, let me take a step back.
Where would you get the cube roots?
Okay. I can write down integrals that are a step of complexity above elliptic integrals. Maybe those integrals don't correspond to any Feynman parametrized integral that we would normally consider. So I got a little bit excited there. Maybe too excited to be warranted, but
one last question.
Yeah.
Have people computed these minimum surface area in 85 with the IR game?
That's essentially the regulator that Alde and Malacena had to do. They put an infrared brain here. They put a cutoff a short distance away here. And that regulates the area. You get a finite area. And then all they had to do was translate. You know, so there's some mu here, which is very small. They had to translate that mu regularization to dimensional regularization. So in fact, that's how they
regulate IR divergence.
I'm sorry?
They use that to regulate.
Absolutely, yeah. That's how they actually do the calculation, yeah.
Any more questions? Then let's thank Marcus again. And he's a really friendly guy, so. Anyway,
but sometimes I get a little too excited.
Anyway, he's a friendly guy.
I spend too much time with Nima, maybe.